This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi folks, I'm Jack Kennedy and welcome to Farm Tech Talk, the livestock show. We have the sun, rain and wind, and while CAP is making the headlines, in general, prices remain good across all the sectors, dairy, beef and sheep. Shout out to our supporters, the European Milk Forum and Grassland Agro for helping us make this happen. I'm going to talk to Adam, Darren, John and indeed Siobhan. And later in the show, we'll be joined by Zoe Kavanagh and Marianne Walsh to talk dairy sustainability. As per normal, we'll start with the quickfire buzz around. So let's get straight into it. Remember, email your questions to farmtechtalk@farmersjournal.ie or WhatsApp 086-836-6465. Thanks indeed for your questions this week. Adam, looking at you first in terms of the suckler and beef side of the house, two questions here. Let's just read them out here, make sure I get them right. Ask Adam, if I'm buying cattle on mark bids from Northern Ireland, do I need any paperwork from the Northern Ireland Department of Agriculture?
No, basically all you need to do there is, I suppose, register on mark bids, keep hitting the button on the phone, and generally a mark down here will do a lot of that paperwork for you. So an animal has to be within 30 days test or else it can't be exported. It has to go through, we'll say, a pass for the export. So for example, I'm familiar with Elfin Mart. Maybe animals are bought on a Monday evening at their export test. They'll generally be exported on a Thursday or a Friday of that week, and a haulier will come in and basically drop them in the yard. The department staff would clear them in that mart on the Thursday or Friday. So a lot of that is done for you.
Okay, another quick one for you, Adam. Ask Adam, what has the suckler cow scheme worked in the new CAP? So obviously it's something we come to in the main show, Adam, but I suppose the question is, ask Adam, what has the suckler cow scheme worked in the new CAP?
Yeah, we don't have that detail yet, Jack. I guess the last scheme, if we merged the two schemes together, it would have been 175 for the first 10 cows and 150 for the next, we'll say, 80 or 90 or whatever it is. I would expect a little bit higher in this next round, but we're not sure yet what it's going to be.
Okay, good. We'll come back to that, Adam, in the main show. Darren, quickfire for you. There's two questions here again. Ask Darren if they will hold off buying your lambs or hogs tomorrow.
Yeah, Jack, I suppose, look, prices are up, but you can't change the system, and we will still be buying, say, some mules. Now, we changed slightly, and we're keeping some of our own Texas crosses, so that will maybe insulate us a small bit, but no, look, we'll still be buying. You have to keep in the system you're in.
Okay, and a second question related to that, Darren, is do you think the price of hoggets will fall back? So the trade has started for hoggets. Do you think the price of hoggets will fall back?
Jack, you don't want to be talking back to trade of anything. I suppose, look, at all we can go on is the details we have. The trade has been a small bit, say, I suppose, I won't say weaker in the last week. I suppose we started off this time last week talking about the Tulla sale as the barometer. I still think that the specialist sales, like the Suffolk Chevys, the Mules, whatever, all of them sales, I think will be very hot. I think that your general run of Hoggets will probably be a bit back from that and will probably settle or stabilise in the next week to 10 days.
Okay, excellent. That's it for you, Darren. John, two quick ones on the grass side of things. Is it too late to take out round bales?
No. I wouldn't be saying so, Joe. There's a huge variation still across farms on grass supply. So, like, I know we're talking about building covers there a good bit now at the minute, but like, if you're way ahead of what your target is, you're going to have to take out surpluses, or else you're going to end up going into too heavy a covers there in mid-September into October. And like, if weather conditions are harsh at that stage, it's going to be very hard to get good graze outs on them. So no, I'd be taking out any surpluses or correcting quality in paddocks that haven't been cut yet this year.
Good man. Okay, mightn't be too late, but it might be a bit wet at the moment. Would John spray for weeds in June reseeds in August? And what spray is best to mine clover? So obviously this farmer reseeded in June. He's looking at his weeds now, and here we are in the middle of August. What spray is best to mine clover?
Yeah, so definitely, like, when you're spraying, post-emergent spray is your best chance of having a clean reseed. Now, I suppose, look, if it depends on what part of June it was done, but if it was done middle of June, sure, what are we, 5 or 6 or 7 weeks since then? So the weeds should be well ready to be sprayed at this stage. So, if there's clover in the mix, then you have to go clover safe. So there is, there's a couple out on the market this year. They brought some back on an emergency license there to cover people who are putting in clover. So I know there's Clover Max and a couple of others there. That definitely look, they're doing the job now. They are, I think, mid-September, kind of around the 15th to 20th of September, their license is finished. So and people have until then to use any clover safe sprays they have. But I'd definitely be spraying this. It's your best chance to get rid of the weeds.
Okay, nice one. Thanks for that, John. Come back to you in a minute. Right, folks, that's it for the quick fire round. Before I go back to Adam, I just want to have a quick word with Siobhan, because Siobhan, you're working on the sustainability side of the house for us. You're working a lot in the tillage side of it. And I suppose I'm just kind of maybe asking you a few questions related to kind of, I suppose, the livestock sector in terms of maybe straw supplies and in terms of what's the kind of harvest update in terms of grain, et cetera, and that kind of thing. Where's that falling out? So, Siobhan, if I could come to you and kind of, I suppose, just give us a kind of, from a livestock perspective, like a kind of a perspective on where the harvest is and kind of straw supplies, with the whole issue around chopping. We had you on previously talking around that in terms of, I suppose, was there going to be a real shortage of straw this coming winter? Talk to us about kind of an update on where that piece is now.
Yeah, well, I suppose the good thing is, Jack, crops are generally good. Farmers are generally happy with the harvest. Grain yields are good up to now. And we've had a great run of it so far with the weather until this past week. So winter barley, winter barley straw is really good quality. Variability in yields. From 10 bales to the acre, average probably 12, and a few exceptions of 14 or 15 bales to the acre. And I suppose winter barley area is up this year as well, which is important to remember. So, you know, where winter barley was at 51,000 hectares last year, it's up to 67,000 this year, but still hasn't gone back to that peak of 2019 when it was over 80,000.
Okay. So, Sean, for the uninitiated in terms of, you know, chopping, I mean, is the majority of straw going to be chopped of that winter stuff that's cut now, or is it going to be the spring stuff that's going to be chopped, or kind of what way will that play out?
So it's from now on. When we reported from the department, it was about 38,000 hectares in the scheme. That's now dropped down, we think. We've no official figures, but we think to about 35,000 hectares, or a little bit, maybe a little bit higher. The majority of the straw that will be chopped will be oats and oilseed rape. So 33% of the straw in the scheme is oats, 45% of the total oat area. Oilseed rape is a large amount. So, you know, while there is a bit of a market for oilseed rape, a large chunk of the straw is oilseed rape. 22% is wheat and 25% is barley. And to put that into perspective, only 5% of the total barley area is in the scheme. So, you know, the amount of barley that's in there is relatively low, but still, you know, a lot of farmers would be using wheat and oats and straw, depending on your market or your locality. The demand is there. I hear farmers now saying, you know, maybe I shouldn't have went into the straw scheme. There's, you know, relatively good prices. And, you know, people, let's say, who have oats in are kind of saying, God, maybe I shouldn't have chopped it. But there is plenty of chopping going on. And just, okay, it's important as well. So spring barley area has gone down quite a bit from last year. It was 140,000 hectares last year, and it's 116 this year. So some of that area went back into wheat. So some of that spring barley area has gone down.
Okay. And Siobhan, and just in terms of prices, and obviously there's a range across the country, but just for your kind of standard round 4x4, any kind of indication on price of where it is, and where is that relative to kind of last year? Is it up or down, or where
yeah, look, you're looking at 20 euro at the minute. And as usual, until the straw comes onto the market, we're not going to see a change from that, really. Regulars are probably getting it below those prices. But 20 euro from anyone I'm hearing who's selling to people who are traveling for their straw, it's probably 20 euro. People are delivering straw locally for 25. But really, you know, the straw scheme has put a value on straw. People aren't going to be selling for below 18 euro. Definitely, if you're loading them in the field, you can't be going below those prices.
Okay. Now that gives us a feel. Last question for you, Siobhan, and I'll leave you go then. A lot of talk this week, I suppose, in terms of that UN IPCC climate report and kind of what was in it or what was not. And I suppose the whole area around climate change that's happening globally, of course, not just in Ireland. We had another report out then later on in the week in terms of kind of an Irish perspective on it from some of the universities and Mate Aaron and a few others saying that climate change is real, et cetera, and that kind of thing. In terms of the IPCC report, I suppose, that UN report at the start of the week, there was a piece around methane and I suppose how it's calculated. Can you maybe just kind of very kind of simply kind of just talk about what was that kind of issue around methane and how it's calculated and what that means for kind of livestock farmers, I suppose, in Ireland, or what it potentially could mean if methane was calculated a different way?
Yeah, so we know methane is a really potent gas. It's, you know, it's a greenhouse gas. It's causing global warming. It's very harmful. But at the minute, it doesn't last as long in the atmosphere. And at the minute, it's being treated in the same way as the other gases. So carbon dioxide lasts for 100 years in the atmosphere, is estimated to last for 100 years. Methane is estimated to last for about 10 or 12. So there's a new method. We've often heard of this guy in Oxford, Miles Allen, talking about the GWP star. And that's a new method. So carbon dioxide is measured on GWP 100, and methane is at the minute as well. But this GWP star is for short-lived gases like methane. So it's basically going to take into account the methane that's there at the minute and then the 20-year period as opposed to the 100-year period. So how long it lasts over a 20-year period. And basically, you know, that's good news for farmers, because it shows that, you know, maybe we're not, that methane isn't causing as much harm as it was. But look, methane is still a very potent gas. We're still going to need to make reductions. But if the herd stays stable now, by the time we get to 2040, because our herd has increased over the past 10 years, if we get to 2040 when the herd has stabilized, that can show, you know, we can maybe go climate neutral in agriculture if we use this GWP star. But look, methane is a potent gas. We are going to have to make reductions, but there are loads of new technologies coming on stream that we can make reductions with, you know, even clover, but things like feed additives and boluses as well.
Yeah, okay. So it's a moving space, Siobhan, and there's a piece coming on, I suppose, in terms of measuring methane differently, and that might, it's not a get-out-of clause, as you say, for agriculture or for farming, but it might help just in terms of being a little bit more accurate. 100%, Siobhan, listen, thanks for the info on the straw and that side of things and on the methane. Chat to you soon again.
Thanks, Jeff.
Adam, coming back to you, I suppose, and look at, you know, call a spade a spade. It's CAP this week. It's CAP. It's kind of distilling what came out of CAP the first week. This is the kind of second week since we got some kind of results or some detail in terms of the CAP piece. The suckler cow scheme And I suppose the issue around limiting, I mean, we briefly touched off it last week because we just got the early details on it. Like, you have a bit more on it kind of this week in the paper, and I suppose a bit more understanding from the town hall meetings. Give us a feel for where you are now in terms of the suckler cow scheme and the cap on terms of suckler cows that's been proposed.
Actually, look at Jack, it's disappointing. I suppose we should be here talking about a very positive scheme in terms of merging BDGP and BEEP. And I know the whole talk is around this cap and issue around the suckler cow. And we got confirmation during the week that that is the case. If a farmer joins the scheme in 2023, they won't be allowed increased cow numbers for the duration of that contract, which is a 5-year contract with the Department of Agriculture. It'll be based on a reference period or a reference number of cows. If the initial proposal was that for example, Jack, if I calve 25 cows in 2023 and I calve 20 cows in 2024, my reference or my payment, we'll say reference number, will drop back down to 20. That was maybe at one of the town hall meetings, maybe the department inclined that maybe they'll look back at that, that maybe they might revisit that and look at that again. But the other, I suppose, issue around penalising farmers if they increase numbers, that seems to be hammered home quite well. The department are arguing that it's not a cap on suckler cow numbers. Look at Jack, it is a cap. If I go into the scheme, I can increase my cow numbers. And look at suckler farmers, very, very angry, massive reaction all week. They feel that they're being singled out as a sector to bear the brunt of dairy expansion, a lot of them are saying. And look at it, that's the last thing we want to do, Jack, is pit one sector against the other. But I think the Department of Agriculture have done that in the last week.
Yeah, and I suppose the dairy lads will argue back that they're getting hammered on the other side from the nitrates, et cetera, and a kind of a limitation there. So there's kind of a double whammy, I'll say, going on, that both suckler cows and the dairy industry is getting kind of capped or maximised, we'll say, from the kind of actions both in the cap piece, as you say, on the sucklers and on the nitrate side in the dairy side. So, but Adam, in terms of the suckler piece and kind of, you know, where it can go from here, like, do you see any kind of, do you reckon the department might roll back on it and kind of, you know, remove that cap? Like, I mean, like, the suckler herd is falling. Like, call a spade, isn't it, for the last number of years? Like, so
it is. I mean, so why apply more pressure, Jack, in terms, I think you'll actually see the biggest fall between 20 and 2021, possibly, because you have a number of people didn't go back into BDGP. Mm-hmm. BDGP was probably holding numbers. So I think you'll see a bigger fall this year than any other year. So it already was falling and it was already declining. But you take a young person. I had a farmer on to me the other night, and him and the son were talking, and he just said to him, look at daddy, this job is over. They don't want suckler cows. We need to look at something else. And that's really disappointing to see them, a young blood coming into an industry, maybe want to keep suckler cows or want to increase cows. If you said to any man they can't grow their business over the next 5 years, what future is there in that business? Or what future is there in any company if you can't grow your business, grow your numbers? It's just sending out all the wrong messages. And I suppose suckler farmers, all they want is for a Minister for Agriculture to have their back, or somebody to fight their cause, or somebody to stand up and say, look, these are very, very important. And in terms of the environmental cost as well, there's a whole other argument there, Jack. All these cows are situated in the west of Ireland, low level of nitrogen application, low stocking rate, massive habitats and biodiversity on a lot of those farms. They genuinely feel that they're not the issue here. It's plain to be seen. Look at it. And the Minister of Agriculture at the IFA AGM in January said no other sector should have to bear the environmental cost of dairy expansion. And yet here we are being asked to cap suckler cow numbers. And it's not fair and equitable, because all the other sectors, and I've nothing against sheep or I've nothing against dairy cows, but in the other two schemes, there is no talk of cap on numbers.
Yeah, now the same support probably isn't there for the other sectors as coming into the suckler piece. Like, that's probably fair to say as well, is it?
Well, look at the argument. It's an animal welfare support, but just the aesthetics of it that to come in. And, you know, look, be straight with people. Come out and say, if we want a cap on suckler cow numbers, shifting it in at the bottom of a scheme proposal document on the side and making it part of BDGP and BEEP, come out and be upfront with people and say, look, lads, we can't go on here. We need to cap cow numbers. This is the way we're going to do it. And maybe, Jack, it's a quote. A system or something where if a young person wants to increase in cow numbers, they can increase, but they need some sort of, we'll say, remit from the department. And if an old person is getting out, well, then maybe that young person could take that quota.
Yeah. Some bit of an entry into the game, as you say. That's your big gripe. Adam, in terms of the other bits and pieces that you've picked up, we'll say, like, obviously there's a, like, in CAP in general, there's a big shift into environmental piece, like, you know, so the whole piece around eco schemes and the whole piece around the new environmental scheme. I mean, again, how will that impact on the suckler sector? Like, I mean, will they go for that environmental scheme? Do you reckon? Have they gone for it in the past?
I think they will, Jack. I think towards the west of the country would definitely be okay. As I've said, a lot of part-time operations, you know, with a lot of habitat areas and farms, there'll be no trouble. We'll say there was a high participation in reps over the years, a high participation in GLOS in the west of the country. Maybe toward the east, where you have farmers on very good land, you know, pushing on, trying to do the best they can with suckler cows, they're going to come under pressure. And Jack, possibly, you know, in terms of the suckler issue and the suckler capping issue, I don't want to make little of it, but possibly it mightn't be the big issue in terms of when we look, delve deeper into figures. Pat O'Toole done some analysis this week showing that, you know, a fella on or a girl on €473 a hectare entitlements, which is, if you are finishing cattle, if you're anyway, we'll say, you know, pushing on, you're going to be up there around that area. He's looking at a 6,500 drop in the best case scenario by 2026, and a worst case scenario is 8,000 of a drop. That's out of 18,000 of a maximum entitlement value there. That's absolutely massive, Jack. And in terms of, you know, if you compare the suckler cow capping versus that's a big issue.
Correct. And I think you have to watch that. So those in high entitlement earners, like we'll say, they're coming there, you know, that's based obviously on what they were doing in back in 2000-2001. Like, but they're coming in for a big restructuring, really, it's fair to say.
Yeah, it's not a restructuring, Jack. It's a big chunk out of their payment is going to be gone. If it was, maybe it was restructuring, you get it back some other way, you get it back through schemes, you get it back through EQ schemes. But that's with green and with everything in there, you're looking at that sort of a cut. And that's because of that. Chris front loading, Darren, I know more about it, Anne, in terms of, you know, convergence being applied across all payments. Those full-time farmers, I said it to you last week, those full-time farmers on good entitlements, I'd be very, very worried for that system.
Yeah, excellent. Adam, leave it at that for the cap. In terms of the trade, you just give us a quick feel for what happened this week. Any major movements?
Yeah, factories tried to pull a bit of a stunt towards the end of last week, Jack. I guess the bank holiday allowed them to do that. There is some COVID issues out there as well in factories, maybe staffing issues in a couple of factories, and that's maybe, you know, taken throughput down. Factories did try to get prices down to maybe 420, but some factories, everybody didn't move. And once everybody doesn't move, it's always a good for farmers, because that means that they have to come back up again to get cattle. If there's one factory paying more, that factory will generally get cattle. You're talking 420 for bullocks, probably 425 for heifers. Still some people getting 430 for heifers. Sterling has actually strengthened to its strongest value since February 2020. That means very good things for British, we'll say, purchasers, because their money is stronger. So it should mean good for Irish processors in terms of selling beef into Britain. And also European market is strengthening a wee bit as well. So all the signs are there. I think that stunt that they pulled last week, it's not going to work. And I think, as I said, it's going to be steady. Maybe, you know, 5 cent up or down, but it's going to stay around that sort of 420 mark, I think, for the foreseeable future.
Good man, 100%. Thanks, Adam. Chat again next week. Darren, moving to you and staying with the cap. Like, I suppose, again, we've had, I suppose, the first couple of town hall meetings, and they were termed, I suppose, consultations, but there wasn't a huge kind of, I suppose, opportunity for farmers or farm organizations to engage with the department on that space. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, Jack, I think that is very fair to say. And I think, look, the aspect I'd look at would be around even the transparency of questions. Is this, there was no feel for what was the I suppose maybe the hot topic. So we all know, as Adam said, the sucklers, we all know some of the other schemes, the dairy, TAMS equipment. But to be fair, the department had a lot of people on it, answered the questions well, but you got no sense of how many questions were asked on sucklers, how many questions. And I think that could have been improved if there was a carousel to show how many questions were coming in or the feedback on it. It was, and I know, look, they tried to change it around throughout the week, but you would have to say that it has to be a learning curve for future, say, maybe meetings or for future consultation phases. Hopefully for the next one, you'll be back sitting around the table. But you'd have to say, Jack, this, there's cause to push out the consultation phase, and I think that would be a good step, given the whole complex nature of getting under the figures, getting under what's happening. Like, look at Jack, the way I'd look at this is, in a week where the department announced that there was going to be EID tagging was going to come into force, we're not hearing anything about it because of, you have nitrates, you have CAP, like two major complex issues, Jack, and you're saying this, all your submissions have to be in and dusted within 2 weeks. Like, it's very tight.
Yeah, it is. Like, now, I get the feeling, Darren, that the kind of consultation piece, while it, as you say, officially ends the end of August, I have a feeling like there is a kind of a consultation that's going to continue into September, October, and right up until the end of the year, and that there can be kind of changes to the schemes right up until then. Like, I mean, that's so it's not over until the kind of fat lady sings right up until the end of the year, it's fair to say.
No, definitely not, Jack. And I think, look at this, I think that what some farmers are highlighting is this. Minister McConlogue was very vocal in saying that he wanted, I think there was a phrase saying he wanted to bring this consultation to every kitchen table, to every dairy parlour, to every shed. Like, and I think that's what farmers sort of are missing from this is the actual sort of the one-to-one or the group meeting or that is to, and look at Jack, like there's a lot still not known about this because of it's so complex. Like the department in their modelling, they worked on 1 year of a model. Had our tool this week, went beyond that to show the scale of the cuts. I've talked to farmers in the last few days who knew that it was going to have an implication on their business, but had no idea how, I suppose, maybe intense the cuts were going to be. Or, like, there's still a lot of learning around eco schemes, around Chris, around front loading. Chris to a lot of people doesn't mean a lot. Like, there's a lot around that without even taking into convergence.
Yeah. I mean, and Darren, you know, as you say, that the headlines are the kind of the fact that the milk and equipment scheme is not in it, in the TAMS, the suckler cow piece. Like, but the big one is the big changes that are happening in this CAP, like without a shadow of a doubt, like is the kind of, I suppose, the shift from pillar one money into kind of environment, into the eco schemes, and that whole new environmental scheme in pillar two. Like that's going to make up a large chunk of, I suppose, what I call the single farm payment or the business, it's going to make up a large, part of the check for a lot of farmers in the coming years.
A massive, Jack. Like even say Van Moran gave some great examples, to be fair, about say around eligible hectare, around scrub, mm-hmm. around eco schemes. Like eco schemes are only starting to learn a bit more about them. And like, look, we know a bit, we've talked a bit about the REAP, like we've talked a bit around grassland meadows, around extensive farming. That's going to become the norm going forward. Like, and your agri-environmental scheme is going to be a higher measure above this. Like, did anybody or any farmer that thinks, oh, I'll go into an agri-environment scheme and I'll have to maybe be more extensive or manage habitats more? Every farmer is going to have to do that to get your eco scheme payment back, or it'll be a condition of some of that, because mm-hmm. the direction of travel in this is very much changing. Where you have a situation where one of the proposals on the table is that agricultural activity can now be put over 2 years as opposed to every year. Like, that is a big sea change, Jack, in where farming has gone. There was a lot of talk in the last CAP on whether or not 0.15 of a livestock unit was anywhere near enough to determine agricultural activity. Now you're talking it could be every 2 years for certain, under certain circumstances. But I think that it's just using the example to show, I suppose, maybe where the whole shift is going around, say, the environment side of things and where the money is going to. And like for a lot of people, I think that it's very straightforward or very simplistic to look at an eco scheme and say it is worth 64 euros a hectare. Mm-hmm. Getting that 64 euros a hectare back is going to be a different scenario, no matter how straightforward.
It's not just going to come as a check in the post. You're going to have to spend money to get it, Darren. Is that what you mean?
That's exactly like, and one of the things I would be afraid of, and one of the things that I think farmers need to be cognizant of as well, and the point was made, I don't know what speaker made it on Wednesday night, was that there can't be a requirement here to get farmers bundled down in paperwork and for having advisors left, right, centre having to fill paperwork to draw down these monies. That they have to be straightforward, because we've seen, Jack, like we've seen in BDGP, we've seen in the sheep welfare scheme, like the two of them schemes, yes, you can pick out holes in them, but they still are bringing money into farmers' pockets. And you're seeing the participation rate at about 60 to 70%. So to get the money that's there back into farmers' pockets has to be straightforward schemes that can deliver money. You mentioned the dairy equipment scheme, Jack. Like, that's one, I suppose, the most consternation around that this week is actually known. Is it in, is it out? And the department haven't closed the door. they've left the door open to say that all of the items are being considered. Ginny, it didn't fill me, you know, with confidence, the reaction up to the questions, to say that they're looking at different things. Like, look at Jack, the money is moving to an environment under Thames as well. Mm. I think the money is going to be under slurry storage. And like you seen that yourself this week, and you've rightly brought it up in your comment about the nitrate action plan. There's going to be a massive pressure on farmers to increase slurry storage in the future years. Yeah. And look at, rightly so, look at this. That's we can't shy away from the fact of slurry management. True. But this is a big change coming in a short period of time that is going to put significant pressure on farmers.
Yeah. Two quick ones, Darren, in terms of, again, some of the discussion, we'll say, in terms of clarifications around active farmer and trading of entitlements, et cetera, and that kind of thing. Is there a kind of obviously they're both very detailed and there's long arguments around each of them, but active farmer, in terms of what the department have said, any particular changes coming up there, and will trading of entitlements continue, do you reckon?
Yeah, I'll take the second one first, Jack, because it's clearest in my mind. First, the trading of entitlements has to continue. The department has said that even if they didn't want to, that they have to by EU law. There's a couple of little things, Jack, that I'll just specify in that, because they're coming up in questions a lot in the things. There's going to be no new entitlements. The entitlements that are there at the minute will stay there. There's going to be no stacking. There's going to be no, say, naked land getting entitlements. There's been questions around the Scottish derogation on will there be more entitlements coming in certain areas. The entitlements we have now, I think it's roughly 170,000 pairs. They are what's going to be there. There is going to be ways of leasing entitlements out, leasing them in. There is going to be ways of selling entitlements. We don't know any detail around clawback, around selling. The big change in entitlements is that, and there was a good line, is that convergence doesn't recognize any, I suppose, schemes, and it's a convergence is going to happen across all entitlements. Anybody heading into a lease now, they need to be cognizant of, if you're going in at high value entitlements at the beginning, what you're coming back out with will be total different value entitlements. And I think people need to be cognizant and aware of that.
Yeah.
Around active farmer, Jack, yes, there will be sort, I suppose, maybe changes there. There will need to be, I suppose, there's no change per se in the agricultural activity is still agricultural activity. They didn't say much around the sort of the whole armchair farmer, that type of thing. I think that might come some sort of maybe restrictions around entitlements or that. The only change around that is the one I mentioned in this. For some people or for some some areas that are termed as very high environmental status or high nature value, well, then you may have an agricultural activity every 2 years. They've specified or they've answered that people taking cuts of silage or cuts of hay, that's classified as an agricultural activity as long as... I think it all goes back to the active farmer has to be in control of the livestock, has to be in control of the land. There's any inclination that they're not, and as say on paper they are, and that someone is coming in and cutting the silage or cutting the hay, that won't be tolerated. I think confirmation around that side of things.
Okay. Darren, I will leave it there because there's a lot there for people to digest, and obviously there's a lot in the paper again for them to get their head around. Is there any other one element that's jumping out at you from the whole CAP piece in terms of what we have, like we've talked a lot about with Adam and we talked with yourself. Is there anything else that kind of, you know, you guys need to start thinking about or kind of start looking into for their own situation? Because like this comes down to their own check at the end of the day. They have to kind of see where it's going to end up, as you said, in 2025, 2026. That's the important part.
Yeah, and like what I would say, Jack, and some farmers have talked to me about this, is that on some farms it might be going to recognise an area that, Ginny, I'm not going to try and reclaim that area. I'm not going to put huge money into maybe draining that area or doing a lot of land improvement, that I can do without that, and that might fit into an environmental scheme or fit into a 5% maybe fallow, say, leaving land idle. Farmers are going to have to be cute around how they're going to draw down the money, how they're going to look at that going forward. And I think that the whole days of saying intensification, we will have to relook at that, I think, and that for some farmers is to see how they fall into that. There's two other things. Organics, if people are going to be interested, it's definitely coming that there's going to be a priority access to that, higher payments in particular for dairy, tillage, horticulture. If people are going to want to go that way, now is the time to be looking at say, gearing your farm up for that down along the line.
The market is probably the big one there. You have to make sure you have a market for the product. You might get the check in the post for organics, but you mightn't have a market for your product.
Exactly. Look, I think the market will be there for tillage, horticulture, and the dairy side. The beef and sheep is more questionable, Jack. And I would be look at the other one is if people have TAMS and dairy equipment, that start to get your house in order. TAMS is going to close at the end of the year. Just in case that doesn't feature Jack in future schemes. Now look, I think TAMS will roll over to next year. There was a question asked the other night, and I won't lay in this, is about will GLAS roll over, will TAMS roll over? The department got approval last year to roll over them. It's all pending that the national finances will be there to co-finance them. The EU have given the go-ahead, it'll depend on that. But I think that you will have schemes next year as well. So I wouldn't just panic totally, but I would start, if people have jobs to do, to start planning now to get into this planning stage.
100%. Darren, I'll keep going. Thanks for that. We'll chat again next week. John, we touched off it with Adam and Darren, I suppose. I mean, that whole piece around the eligibility for dairy equipment in the TAMS, like, I mean, you would have featured this week on a farm that had put in, installed a 20-unit milking parlour. They had got their grant aid on it. Like, I mean, it's vital for anyone that's doing a big investment like that on farm. They're spending 200, 250, 300,000 in some cases. Like, it's a huge amount of money.
Yeah, exactly. And Joe, you see, it's a great incentive for farmers to improve the equipment. And Joe, at the end of the day, you're trying to produce high quality milk. There's like Joe, your standards are getting higher and higher as years go on, and milk processors want a higher quality milk. So Joe, it's improving the equipment, and it's a great incentive for helping, like Joe, to get it in.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the other piece to that, John, is like, you know, we talk about sustainability and environmental sustainability, but kind of the working time and lifestyle, and, you know, the dairy game is a full-time game, like you're full-time working. So, I mean, if you're spending hours and hours in a milking parlour, I mean, it's sustainable to have a good one and do it properly and try and, I suppose, limit how much time you're spending in that parlour. Like, there's a sustainability piece in it as well.
Yeah, definitely. And Joe, it seems like Joe, with the scheme, you can upgrade your bulk tank, which means you're updating the machine. So even if you just break it down to one thing, like milk cooling and like saving on electricity costs, and Joe, it is definitely all a huge benefit by improving all those different things. And as you said, time wise, like Joe, you're in there twice a day for, I know farmers are targeting around a 305 day lactation or that, and Joe, it's you're in there twice a day, so I definitely want to be getting more efficient.
I mean, the other big one that came out of the nitrates, John, this week, I suppose, is the slurry storage space, and that, you know, so there's a requirement there, you know, for extra slurry storage because of the spreading piece has tightened up or widened out, or whatever way you want to put it, like, you know. But the soil water piece is a big one as well, John, and that's going to impact especially on those, I suppose, that are milking during the winter. Before, it was you had to have 10 days storage for soil water, but I mean, look at in the next year or 2 years, like, effectively soil water is going to become slurry. You're going to have slurry storage space or capacity for holding that soil water. That'll impact on a decent few farms.
Yeah, definitely will. Like when people would have been up to the last couple of years putting in their new parlours or upgrading their systems and putting in their soil water, they would have gone and put in a tank behind that, usually in the collecting yard, that would hold enough for 10 days. Like, and I think that's gone up to near 4 weeks. And another side of it too is on the whole slurry storage side of things, is there's an awful lot of open top cubicles with tanks that aren't covered either, and they're all going to have to be covered, and the likes of your lagoons and stuff. So that's going to put a massive expense on farmers like Joe, and Joe. They were all things that they were advised to do in the past to kind of to increase their storage, but now obviously rainwater and stuff getting in is affecting that.
The other one, John, in terms of organic nitrogen, I mean, Adam talked about the sucker cow cap, like, but effectively the nitrate is limiting dairy cows, like, I mean, the cow now has gone to 92 kilos of organic nitrogen, the kind of typical cow, will say, in that producing kind of between 4.5 and 6.5. I mean, higher yielding cows have even gone higher to 106 kilos of organic nitrogen or slurry cow. And if you're limited at 250 or 230 or whatever it might play out at, I mean, effectively, you're capped in terms of what dairy stock you can have on the farm. You know, it's really tightened up in terms of that stock and rate piece, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And Joe, I lost you there for a second, but on the cow, breaking down the cows through their through production will affect, like, it definitely, and I suppose it's going to affect more the further north you go up the country. That's going to have a massive effect on that, on the more high yielding herds and stuff. So, like, pushing them up to 106 will affect stocking rates, and in a lot of cases on those higher producing farms, they may be stocked higher and working off a milking platform, and putting in more inputs in that. So it'll definitely, Joe, it's going to cause massive issues. And Joe, people are going to have to be given time to their systems are going to have to tweak their systems to make sure that they can still make it. And Joe, it's always come back, if they're pushing environment and sustainability, like, it has to be a sustainable place to work. And like the lads were saying earlier, like, you have to be encouraging people and the next generations too. You have to be encouraging them to want to get into it as well, and not turn them off it, really, at the end of the day with different things.
No. I mean, it's definitely, I mean, there's a piece here, John, I suppose, and I'll leave you with this, is that, you know, all farmers, dairy farmers, are going to have to kind of reassess where they are in terms of investment needed and, I suppose, stocking rate, you know, given these new proposals that are there on the nitrates. They're really going to just kind of have it, and, you know, they've all done kind of supplier surveys in terms of milk yield over the next 5 years or whatever. I mean, really, it's a case of they need to go back to the books now, look at what money needs to be spent on the farm, and look at the cow numbers they have, et cetera, and that kind of thing, and really ask themselves the question, is this what's going to continue to happen for the kind of next 5 years of their own business?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's having to future. So anyone that is making plans of that, like, you have to future proof it as well. So, like, getting in that extra slurry, like, you may not need the extra slurry storage now, but, like, the likelihood is it's going to be needed down the line in a very short time, and putting in extra allowances for that will future-proof the thing. And as I say, yeah, it's going to be, like, definitely getting involved them with them discussions and trying to push the importance of all these schemes and what benefits they have been in the past will definitely look. It's about, again, it's like last week with talking to your co-ops and your processors about milk price, it's the same thing. We have to have our voices heard and emphasize how important this has been in the past. So.
Excellent, John. Listen, we haven't had time to touch off the farm side, but we'll come back to that again next week. John, thanks for your time. Folks, earlier I had a chat with Zoe Kavanagh and Marion Walsh, and we talked about the whole area around dairy sustainability and how that's going to affect diets into the future. Let's have a listen to what we talked about.
It's a complex topic, but in short, sustainable diets are diets that are aimed at being maintained in the long term for better health and better nutrition. And really, they're aimed at addressing two major problems that are facing the globe at the moment. The first one is poor nutrition leading to poor health. And the second one is the impact of food production on climate change. So if we start with the first one, nutrition and poor health. At the moment, 20% of deaths globally are associated with poor diet. It's hard to believe, but 2 billion adults globally are either overweight or obese. And we know that obesity is linked with many higher risk of many diseases like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, cancers. And then at the same time as this obesity epidemic, we have about 820 million people who are undernourished in the world. So these are people who are going to bed hungry every night or perhaps have a nutrient deficiency. And at the same time as this food shortage for some people, one third of the food produced globally is going to waste every year. And then from the food production perspective, we know that 20 to 35% of global greenhouse gas emissions are linked to food production. So these are things like agriculture, manufacturing, packaging, transport, and so on. Mm-hmm. So I suppose this is also compounded by the fact that we've got a growing global population. So as you know, there's 7.3 billion people in the planet at the moment. It's predicted that this is going to go to 10 billion by 2050. And the issue here is if we keep going as we are, food production is going to have to go up by 50% at the same time as we're trying to bring the carbon footprint of food production down. So that's what sustainable diets are aimed at addressing, all of these complex issues.
So it'll do well if it answers all those questions. But I suppose specifically on the dairy side of things, like, I mean, where does dairy fit into kind of the sustainable diet? And I suppose the products that we associate with dairy, fresh milk and cheese, etc.
Yeah, so the World Health Organization and the UN suggest that a sustainable diet should have four pillars, and you should balance off these four pillars. So the first pillar is nutrition. It should be nutritionally safe and adequate. The second one is that the food in this diet should be culturally acceptable. And the third one is economics. It should be economically affordable. And the fourth one is the environment, of course. So it should be respectful of biodiversity and the environment. And really, I suppose a sustainable diet looks different in Ireland as it does in Africa or Australia. Mm. But no matter where we look at sustainable dietary patterns across the globe, there's always a place for dairy. And we see dairy popping up in all these different models of sustainable diets. And the reason for that is because of dairy's unique nutrient densities. And that's the amount of nutrients that are packed in per gram of food. And if you look at dairy across those pillars, it's highly nutritious. That's probably the strongest pillar for dairy. It's culturally acceptable. Economically, it's contributing to our economy, but it's also one of the most affordable foods. And then from the environmental perspective, of course, and you've spoken about it before on these tech talks, there's a lot of work to be done. There's also a lot of work taking place. But we must also keep perspective, because milk production is contributing to 3% of global greenhouse gas emissions. So when you look at dairy across those pillars, you can see why dairy is justifying its place in a sustainable diet.
So, Marianne, dairy has a place, as you say, in the sustainable diet. So, I mean, if I look at you and just say in terms of what the National Dairy Council are doing kind of on a European basis, like European and global basis, because, I mean, it's fair to say that, like, there's parts of the world that can't produce dairy like we do here in Ireland. You know, I mean, it's the reality. And they can't help themselves to an extent, because they don't have the climate, they don't have the sustainable environment to produce dairy. Like, I mean, we have a basis, a solid platform producing dairy in Ireland, even on a European context and a global context.
Yeah, I think what's really important in the consideration is, you know, we all know within the agri sector that grass and a grass-based production system, you know, is a fantastic system to have when facing the challenges of climate anxiety. I think what's most important from an NDC perspective and at a European perspective through this European funded programme is that knowledge and recognition isn't just sitting within the agri sector. We need the public to understand it. And as you know, we've anchored a lot of these discussions in consumer research, which took place not just in Ireland, but in the four other European markets that are part of this. The good thing, based on what Marianne's just talked about, is when we speak to Irish public, 78% recognise dairy as being highly nutritious. 82% recognise that a grass-based system is superior to other systems. And interestingly enough, even though we feel that the term sustainable diet isn't well understood, 6 out of 10 said they want to pursue a more sustainable diet. And I think from an NDC perspective and from a European perspective, what we need to do is to stitch together everything Marianne just talked about across those four pillars, mm-hmm. And make sure that dairy is recognized as being highly nutritious, responsibly produced, good for health and health outcomes, affordable and accessible. So I think the body of work we need to do is to, A, you know, tell the good story that can be told, reassure the questioning consumer, and look, being honest, the questioning consumer is looking more and more to the environmental agenda. And while Ireland is, you know, half the average of global emissions, it's a good starting point, but it's not enough. So I think what's very clear to us is a lot of communication required to ensure that dairy firmly remains on the list of recommendations within a sustainable diet.
Okay, I come back to you in a minute, Zoe. I mean, Marianne, in terms of, I suppose, the trends that are happening, I mean, is there, like Zoe mentioned it there, that, you know, environment is maybe becoming more of an issue when people are picking up products on the shop shelf. But in terms of dietary trends, are we seeing a change, I suppose, to kind of, you know, a more environmental, choice consumer, or a more sustainable consumer in terms of looking at sustainability as a key issue when they're picking up that product off the shelf?
I suppose, Jack, dietary trends are constantly changing. And when I look back to when I started working in the NDC about 6 years ago, we were looking at the free-from trend, dairy-free, gluten-free. Then this evolved into the high-protein trend. And then we started seeing an uptake in interest in veganism. And now we've seen that this has kind of evolved into a focus on plant-based, flexitarian, and yes, there has been an increased interest in sustainable diets and sustainable eating patterns. I think one of the things where there's a lot of confusion is in the area of plant-based diets. Quite often people think of them as plant-only diets, which would be obviously a vegan diet, but a plant-based diet can actually contain animal products. And if we even think of our own food pyramid, and I'm sure most people can picture the pyramid, you know that down the bottom, it's fruit and vegetables, you've got your whole grain starches, and then you have your moderate amount of high protein foods. And this is your dairy shelf and your meats, eggs, and things like that. And in Ireland, our recommendations are considered moderate at 3 servings per day.
Yeah. So, I mean, as you say, it can be part of that whole, you know, plant-based diet, as you say. I mean, it's dairy is part of that, and animal products are part of it, even if it's plant-based, because we were always plant-based with our fruit and veggies.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about balance.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a mix. I mean, Zoe, Glanbia, one of the big players in the dairy space, released financial results this week, and they were positive, obviously. But Siobhan Talbot, the boss of Glanbia, was talking to me, and she was talking about sustainability and an issue for Glanbia, and she said, yes, it's an issue, but she sees it as an opportunity, and that, like, that they're going to, as a company, they're going to reduce their emissions by 2050. And farmers, you know, their dairy farmers are going to reduce their emissions. So she says, listen, it's a journey. We have to do it. We have to take it on board. We have to change. Are you confident, Zoe, that, like Glanbia say they'll do it? Are you confident other dairy companies and, you know, milk suppliers will kind of take on the change around that whole sustainability piece and reducing the carbon, which is important, which is necessary?
Yeah, I'm a firm believer if we do two things in parallel well, Ireland can be, you know, a leading dairy producing nation. And the two things done well in parallel is, one, that collectively all dairy producers do what has been recommended and proven to reduce emissions, increase the nature of biodiversity, protect waterways. So I think that action plan cannot be restricted to sort of an exclusive group of the top 10%. This needs to be all producers, and prioritizing it. And look, as we well know, between cap reform and climate action bills, I think the system needs to be set up to strike a balance of enabling producers to do what's right, while also rewarding them as food producers. So that's one part of it. And in parallel, I think the big opportunity for dairy here now is to communicate and remind and shine a light on the nutritional contribution. Because as Marianne has said, you know, gram for gram, it's unmatched. And I think what's quite interesting, 5 years ago, when we would have been somewhat defensive about these innovative products hitting the shelves, feeling that they were, you know, stealing dairy's emperor's cloak, so to speak. The reality is when you break it down and compare them nutritionally, nothing has matched dairy, nothing. So I think that parallel path and sort of the reason why Siobhan can feel so confident is we've got the crown jewels of the nutritional contribution with really positive health outcomes, alongside, I think, a recognition among all our dairy producers that practices on farm will have to change, and they will change. Obviously, they need to be incentivized. But once we get that environmental piece lined up with the nutritional piece, I'd like to see Ireland you know, 2030, 2035, almost holding itself up as saying best small dairy producing nation in the world. Mm. We can get it right.
Yeah, I hear you. Like, so there is positivity there. Farmers are willing to take it on, and the companies are leading that, and NDC are telling the world about that. Marianne, to finish with you in terms of, you know, your nutrition manager with the NDC, what are you doing to kind of, I suppose, inform consumers about the role of dairy in diets, or how do you get your messages across, we'll say, to the whole wide community that's out there?
So I suppose in all of our nutrition communications, we try to weave in some messaging around the unique sustainability of Irish dairy and also the role of dairy in a sustainable diet. So just for example, we work with consumers and healthcare professionals. And in the last couple of years, we've had webinars for healthcare professionals specifically focused on sharing the science around sustainable diets and highlighting the role of dairy. We've also produced scientific articles that get circulated in magazines for healthcare professionals. And then for the consumer, we've produced a little booklet on eating sustainably. And that really takes the complex topic and sets out the simple facts around sustainable eating and where dairy fits. We've also got an online interactive tool. As you know, everything's going online at the moment. So we have an online interactive tool, which is designed to educate consumers around sustainable eating. And also we're doing a very interesting project at the moment with the European Milk Forum, where we're looking at the sustainability of typical European diets. And we're looking at, if you make changes to the diet, what is the impact on the sustainability of the diet in terms of carbon footprint, land use, water use, and cost? And so, like, for example, if you increase dairy or if you decrease dairy, what's the impact on the sustainability of the diet? And so far, we're seeing quite positive results for dairy. So we're looking forward to completing that project and sharing the results with healthcare professionals, and then it'll trickle on in the messaging to consumers as well.
Right, folks, that's it for another week. Thanks for watching and indeed for listening. Thanks to all our own guests, and also Zoe Kavanagh and Marianne Walsh from the National Dairy Council. If you want more Farmers Journal webinars, go to ifj.ie/webinars, or you can listen to this show on a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back again next week. Until then, stay safe and safe farming.